My name's Nima Gadiri. I'm a consultant medical ophthalmologist at Liverpool, and this is an amuse-bouche in AI as part of our Eye on Liverpool podcast series. This is actually an introduction for those who might find AI as a little bit of a grey, murky area prior to our later podcasts as part of this 12-part series, mainly the one with Professor Yaling Zheng and a later episode with Nick Baer. This is just an informal introduction. The podcast logo you can see on the right was actually designed with AI. I just fed it the prompt of a liver bird looking down at the city of Liverpool, and you be the judge of how accurate the end product is, but at least it's a cute little logo. Our podcast is available here on Spotify, on Audible, on Apple Podcasts, wherever you might find your podcasts. And as mentioned, it's 12 parts and there'll be a monthly release. And this is just, as mentioned, the informal introduction to AI in ophthalmology. So many of you will have heard of these AI image generators, which have come out over the last few months or have become more popular over the last few months. DALL-E 2 is an AI system which creates realistic images from a description in our own natural language. So on the left, I've asked it to produce Eye Hospital of the Future. On the right, Eye Clinician of the Future. Both somewhat dystopian images, I'm sure you'll agree. DALL-E 2 falls under the umbrella of OpenAI, this research lab initially set up as a collaboration of some famous billionaires as a non-profit. It's less of a non-profit at the moment, but the goal is still to provide a friendly and useful AI. And some of you will have known about these other platforms such as Midjourney, which lets your imagination essentially come to life with AI using a technique based on stable diffusion. So any text input can create various photorealistic images. Here on the left, I've produced an image of myself as a Pixar film and as a Muppet. Quite entertaining. I look a bit like Oscar the Grouch over there, but maybe it's interpreting things that I wasn't aware of myself. And ChatGPT, which has been all over the news over the last few months, almost incessantly, has been taking over. So I can assure you that I haven't used ChatGPT for making this webinar, even though it's being used for all kinds of presentations, even to pass medical school exams, law school exams. And I think this classic Blade Runner scene, where Roy Batty describes his life as rain and tears flow down his face, is the worry that we have with ChatGPT. That's why Elon Musk has just signed a letter alongside a few other influential folk to ask us to put a pause on certain aspects of AI development beyond a certain phase. It's possibly natural to be worried about the spectrum of situations. Is AI going to take over? Are we all going to lose our jobs? Science fiction fans worrying about whether we can't tell what's real or not. Other films like The Matrix come to mind, even the fictional artificial neural network of Skynet and the Terminator taking over. We do have understandable concerns with AI, but for some people it's the promise of AI to help us, which is very important. So with that in mind, having said that, I didn't ask ChatGPT to design this talk. If I had asked ChatGPT to design this talk, this is what ChatGPT would have given me. Which I think is quite a good summary, covers applications of AI in eye health, examples of AI systems, advantages and limitations, and future directions. So, not a bad effort from ChatGPT at all. So, the cornerstone of AI in ophthalmology comes from the ubiquity of imaging and the large data sets that we have in ophthalmology. Color fundus, OCT imaging, OCT angiography, to less extent, external eye imaging in eye clinics and community practices mean that we have a huge amount of data for training neural networks. And we have already automated segmentation within these platforms, which can be fed into deep learning algorithms. Advances in modeling, in cloud-based storage have all accelerated this training. And the COVID-19 pandemic basically pushed things forward and helped us or encouraged us to integrate AI into healthcare. So let's start with a historical perspective. This is a perspective which many people put into their discussions about AI in ophthalmology. When Hermann von Helmholtz first invented the direct ophthalmoscope, which he called the Augenspiegel in 1851, it became possible to look at the back of the eye, visualizing the blood vessels, the optic nerves. We had already high tech for the time, gadgetry, which revolutionise how we look into these beautiful structures in the back of the eye. 1886, William Thomas Jackson and J.D. Webster pioneered ophthalmic imaging, taking photos of the fundus using long exposure cameras and using candles to provide the required illumination. So this is on the bottom left, the first example of a human retina being photographed in photographic news. The large circle represents an artifact caused by the camera. But it wasn't until Carl Zeiss here on the right developed the first commercially available fundus camera that we were able to get examination of the fundus and good photos of the retina. And from 1950s onwards, advances in camera technology such as the electronic flash tube enabled essentially a paradigm shift in the diagnosis of threatening conditions such as AMD, such as diabetic eye disease, retinal vascular diseases, glaucoma. And it was really the advent of digital fundus imaging, higher quality images, storage of larger quantities of data, which enabled us to push forward. In 1991, our now ubiquitous OCT, optical coherence tomography, allowed a swift, non-invasive mode of examining the cross-section of the back of the eye in vivo, a technique which remains a cornerstone for ophthalmic practice for the diagnosis of AMD, diagnosis of glaucoma for diabetic retinopathy, and all over the world, this inexpensive imaging method has transformed our management of retinal and optic nerve diseases, slicing the retina into all these layers and enabling us to get a structural view of the back of the eye. And then that's essentially given us the tools or the substrate for artificial intelligence. So what is artificial intelligence? And when this phrase first came about, it was Marvin Minsky, a Harvard computer scientist in 1955, who first coined this term and essentially described the theory and development of computer systems to perform tasks normally, which might otherwise have required human intelligence. There isn't any easy categorization of AI, but these are some of the phrases that you might hear in AI. So, for example, reinforcement learning, perhaps the most basic form of training there is. This involves giving feedback each time a system performs a task so that it goes from doing things incorrectly to correctly. Can be slow, can be an expensive process, but for systems that interact with the real world, sometimes there's no better way. Large language modules, these are so-called neural networks. They're trained by pouring billions of words, billions of examples of everyday text gathered from sources ranging from books to tweets to everything in between. Large language models then draw on this material to predict words and sentences in certain sequences. Generative adversarial networks, that's where two neural networks are pitted against each other to create something new. These are used in creative processes such as music, such as visual art, such as film making. One network can be the role of creator, whereas the other one might be the role of marker. And the first learns to create something and the second learns to approve of that. And symbolic AI, these are AI techniques which even work and look to the past for inspiration. So it's an approach that rejects the idea of simple neural networks and tries to mix machine learning with more diligently structured facts around the world. All sounds a little bit complicated and jargony perhaps, but let's just think about, you know, the first times when, well, at least I learned about AI and saw it in the news, which was when I was learning about Garry Kasparov beating Deep Blue from IBM 4-2 in 1996. That was for me the first time I thought, wow, AI can really replace humans. 1 year later, of course, Deep Blue came back for revenge and beat Kasparov 3.5 to 2.5. So the message at the time was clear: artificial intelligence was here to stay and was catching up with human intelligence. And Deep Blue's algorithm really did depend on essentially brute computational force, so evaluating millions of positions in chess and deciding which one would be the best to get the goal. And that works fine for chess, in which there's 20 overall moves, but in other games and more complex games such as Go, a game which came about in China around 2.5 millennia ago, it doesn't quite work because Go has 361 potential opening moves on its 19 times 19 grid. So it's so large that AI could never explore victory using the Deep Blue brute force method. So DeepMind's AlphaGo essentially used the supervised learning protocol, essentially watching and analyzing large numbers of games between humans, employing reinforcement learning and maximizing the expected winning outcome. So effectively becoming intuitive, but it has to thank its ancestor Deep Blue for that victory. So what is machine learning? Well, machine learning is essentially AI that can automatically adapt with minimal human interference. It's a subset of machine learning that uses these artificial neural networks to mimic the learning process of the human brain. And this is an example of computational neural network learning applied to one image. So if you look at on the left, that's car, the image of the car, the deep learning algorithm takes that car and assigns importance with learnable weights and biases on parts of that car, various aspects of the image, and eventually is able to differentiate one aspect of the image from the other and gradually builds an output. So it essentially learns associations between the input and the output through classifying or segmenting this image and essentially generating maps of the image, feature maps. And it does this by employing a filter which splits representative different features of the input image. Where the deep learning aspect comes in is where these networks are expanded to essentially include many, many hidden layers and allow for a more intricate evaluation of the input. So eventually it detects features of the image on its own, which might not even be visible to our eye or even be known by experts, and then can classify these features and eventually lead to this answer. So it's that middle part which counts as the deep learning that we have. When applied to ophthalmic imaging, we have essentially the architecture built for the algorithm to learn which features to select from the image. For example, fluid, hemorrhages, exudates, epithelial detachments. And here is an image from the big kind of landmark 2018 paper from Dufao et al. From the DeepMind Morpheus system, where you segment a patient with, on the top, diabetic macular edema, middle choroidal neovascularization as a consequence of age-related macular degeneration, and on the bottom, neovascular AMD. And essentially, this system had two components to produce a device-independent representation. So the first was a segmentation network, similar to what you saw with the image of the car, and that manually trained around 900 segmented images, the objective being to create a transitional representation of the image within which the pathological features have been delineated. Then there's a combination of learning algorithms, which are called ensemble methods, and they're essentially aiming to create a more accurate prediction for each scan. And then there was a classification network. So the output data was trained with almost 15,000 scans to provide quantifiable data. And essentially the goal was to make a triage assessment, so routine, semi-urgent, urgent, alongside a diagnosis. And the outcome was, from this paper at least, that the group said in more than 94% of cases, the referral recommendation made was correct. And with more than 50 retinal diseases, they found that the AI system's performance reached or exceeded that of experts. So the goal here was to reduce time from detection to treatment. Promising. And the exciting part from this is that we can potentially uncover new links between the eye and other diseases that we're not even aware of. So this part is pertinent for me because I'm a medical ophthalmologist, so I deal with the interface between the eye and full body diseases, the eye being a window to full body diseases in a way, to quote Roy Batty, you wouldn't believe. For one thing, the back of the eye shares similar anatomical and physiological properties with the brain, with the kidney. So it's essentially an indirect representation of vasculature and nerve structures elsewhere in the body, especially with the optic nerve visible. It's essentially an extension of the central nervous system. So there's nothing quite like it. I mean, even in the front of the eye, you can see jaundice, cholesterol, anemia. And in the United Kingdom and elsewhere in the world, we do have these huge data sets with our biobanks, with these data repositories. So we can potentially identify vast new ophthalmic features associated with health and disease. And features of the eye could potentially predict people's age, body mass index, sex and smoking status, risk factors not previously considered quantifiable or even identifiable in images. Who knows what else in the future? Here's the burgeoning field of oculomics. So oculomics was a term which was coined just a few years ago by Professor Alistair Denison, and this essentially refers to ocular biomarkers of systemic disease. So, as mentioned, the hope will be that we come up with new ways of prognosticating and identifying diseases that we weren't aware of before in these complex disease relationships. And perhaps we can provide even low-cost ways of screening and help bridge gaps in isolated or under-resourced settings around the world. Retinal fundus cameras are low-cost, simple. Hopefully, around the world, we can integrate these with smartphones. We can have portable ways of using telemedicine and screening in rural, hard-to-reach communities. So, that's for me quite an exciting area of exploring AI to help people around the world, essentially. And so, the prime early effort of ophthalmology when it comes to AI has really been to target common diseases via these imaging modalities, which we use pretty regularly in eye clinics. So the aim is early detection, early screening and staging of sight-threatening eye diseases. We're talking about eye diseases such as diabetes, age-related macular degeneration, cataract, glaucoma, where we've got lots of prevalence and lots of images for big data. And this is big data when combined with AI, which allows us for screening and also to detect these subtle associations that would otherwise be missed with perhaps smaller data sets. So I'll give a quick overview of some of these. Let's look at diabetes first. Diabetes is a leading cause of preventable blindness worldwide, and AI algorithms have been good at detecting clinical significant macular edema together with advanced stages of diabetic retinopathy. And these algorithms have been trained on features of diabetic retinopathy. So these are some examples of deep learning systems used for diabetic retinopathy screening. I'm going back to the early ones from a couple of years ago, for example, the IDXDR algorithm. And this starts essentially with a quality assessment. Then a deep learning algorithm uses these convoluted neural networks for signs such as hemorrhages, such as microaneurysms. And then the disease assessment's made based on the clinical biomarker assessment. It's classified into no diabetic retinopathy, moderate diabetic retinopathy, or vision-threatening diabetic retinopathy. So imagine point-of-care diabetic retinopathy screening with AI cameras, which might be attached to smartphones. Patients just come to their GP and they have a scan which grades their eyes. AI can really change screening for this condition worldwide and can track screening progression. Using AI to classify age-related macular degeneration and predict progression to exudative AMD in patients who have a diagnosis already in one eye, that can be very important when time is short. So deep learning systems have initially used the AREDS data set. The image on the left shows how these convolutional neural networks are trained to classify features from the images and decide whether an image is referable or not. On the right, we have an example of progression to geographic atrophy and neovascularization in AMD. This deep learning model uses automatic segmentation of geographic atrophy and its constituent retinal features. Again, broadly speaking, three elements. One is demarcation of the pathology. The second is pipe-like training with segmentations, looking at specific images, specific features on the input image, and then a validation data set within each scan is created. So it's always got these three elements to the process. In glaucoma, both scans of the optic nerve and the retinal nerve fiber layer thickness and assessments of the visual fields lend themselves to AI. Maybe AI could potentially differentiate between borderline optic nerve appearances. I've just put an example here on the left of feature extraction implemented in deep learning model training. This is used within the Refuge 2 data set. Again, AI could completely facilitate community screening to ensure early diagnosis, to ensure early referral to the glaucoma specialists, particularly with slowly progressing or unclear changes in the visual field. Could deep learning provide a tailor-made management plan and determine the risk of requiring surgery or experiencing visual loss? That's the goal here. On the right, I've got cataract management. Again, the use of AI incorporates diagnosis, referral, and the prediction of refractive outcomes. So I've got a three-step AI algorithm for you here: capture mode, cataract diagnosis, and detection of referable cataracts. And then many other eye diseases. So we've got retinopathy of prematurity, very important in developing countries where we're seeing improved neonatal critical care means that there's a reduced mortality for premature babies, thankfully. But of course, we have more incidents in these instances, in these cases of retinitis of prematurity. So many countries lack programs for screening infants. There's not many specialists who can do this. So again, the integration of retinal photography, telemedicine, and AI models can really help in determining the presence and severity of ROP. So hopefully, this IROP research consortium and their deep learning system, being a work in progress, can really help us identify vascular changes, decide using the AI algorithm what is pre-plus, what is plus disease, and really help us stage these babies. And then there's many other applications of AI, so diagnosis and grading of keratoconus, of Fuchs dystrophy, eyelid melanomas, are they malignant, are they not, periorbital measurements in humans. There's a whole world of potential applications, and we're only just discovering some of these. So AI-powered screening can have a huge impact in hard-to-reach areas. The ubiquity of smartphones, as I mentioned, as a portable camera, makes creating an image acquisition system simple and inexpensive. And already in the UK, we've got entities such as Peak Vision, who've introduced camera adapters which allow high-quality images to be obtained easily and then analysed remotely. Some companies are working really hard to make small form factor, multiple reference OCT, MR-OCT available for smartphones and wearables. Retinal imaging is really progressing, and month on month, there's huge advances being made. So the dream is this combination of improving AI-powered screening software, increasingly compact devices to bridge these geographic gaps, and the approximately 300 million people worldwide living with sight loss. So there's huge scope that we're looking at. There's also scope for AI in drug development. So again, the goal is that new developments can happen with AI and bridge gaps around the world, essentially. And it's hard to do this justice really within this really quick whistle through talk, but there's so many ways in which AI can have an impact on the visually impaired when it comes to assistive technology, especially using image recognition technology can open up the digital world, especially as the interactive media we use evolves from being mainly text-based to featuring other modalities. Screen readers, which interpret video, images, or text using image recognition, can be very important. AI algorithms and smart glasses to detect features and recognize objects, and these can then be presented to the user either via audio or via more easily readable text. Navigation systems on the right, I've got the Waymap platform, which uses AI to hone its navigation tool. And deep learning integrated image filtering can also really help with image processing. And we already have seen that within AI image creation platforms that you can upscale poor quality images. So imagine that implemented with OCT, with Optos, and giving us a higher level of image quality. So this is Clue, or Clue 2 in Tron Legacy. And then what he says here is, I did everything you ever asked for. I created the perfect system. Jeff Bridge de-aged using AI technology there, a version of deep fake technology you see today. So in films, we have so many accounts of AI which just strives to be perfect, such as Clue 2 here, such as Marvel's Ultron, even such as Skynet in Terminator. And the main issue at the moment is that there's a gap or the narrowing between these exciting changes that we're seeing and external clinical validation. So even if we say that AI is as good as healthcare professionals in a study, we need to factor in the limitation. We need to factor in that the study design and analysis needs to really work on the clinical significance. The goal needs to be improvements in patient outcomes, not just comparing AI with how doctors or how other eye healthcare practitioners can do. Many studies also don't comment on the power calculation, which is very important for standardization, for fine-tuning. Quality of the inputs is very important. Some studies don't really have as good quality as others. Slightly aggressively called garbage in, garbage out phenomenon, where the quality of the output and the performance uncertainty, it does depend on what goes in. AI can also be fooled a lot. So, for example, when you see human markings on scans, annotations, and measuring rulers, the AI, the neural networks, is more likely to think that the pathology is going to be serious because there's a marker which suggests that there's been a me measurement from a human. So there's certain things that we don't factor into our AI when we're implementing AI on all these images. One thing which many people talk about is the black box phenomenon. So with AI, with the deep learning algorithms, you might have an input, you might have an output, and you might be aware of, roughly speaking, of what's going on either side, but it's the intermediate process which is a mystery. So it's unclear somehow how the algorithms arrived at such predictions. And it's that opacity of the decision-making process which is becoming more and more vast with our more and more high-tech deep learning algorithms. And in healthcare particularly, it can impact our trust for these systems. We need to understand how the AI is being trained, to understand how generalizable and how replicable these algorithms are for the targeted population. We need to make sure that that we're aware of this so that we don't see biases to ethnicity, to gender, to other factors that we weren't even considering, which can lead to inadvertent discrimination in healthcare delivery, and making sure that there aren't biases in these training sets. So that's crucial for our trust or patient trust in AI-based or AI automated processes, and of course, is important for the clinical utility. Finally, of course, economic considerations do need to be made at all times. Cost-effective analyses need to be made before there's any real-world implementation. And so this letter that we've seen from Elon Musk and friends about putting a pause on AI, or at least all that's happening at the moment with ChatGPT and with well, especially with GPT-4 and with our newer forms of deep learning. The challenge is always to balance, I suppose, the human rationalization of ethics with the necessity to achieve the goal. That's a challenge that Skynet had in the Terminator movies, and we have a lot of people saying the same. So the late Professor Hawking described AI as the best or worst thing. Similar comments from Elon Musk and Bill Gates. I think we're still far away from this, and the controversial early issues really have been when it comes to data sharing and the ethical standards of AI I mentioned. So these need to be considered at every step of the fast-moving evolution of these technologies. That's why we have ethical standards groups, and that's why every paradigm shift of AI has been accompanied by the need to reflect from an ethical standpoint. Over-reliance on technology has been a pitfall in many fields, and obviously AI in ophthalmology isn't an exception. So we need to think of this as a adjunctive tool, not just a clinical surrogate. And there are many nuances in ophthalmic examination that AI just isn't able to synthesize at the moment, particularly the social and psychological aspects. So for the time being, at least, our jobs are safe, and the human aspect to an ophthalmic examination, I hope, will remain. So here's on the right another scary AI themed AI generated image from, I think, DALL-E 2. And this is just what I wanted to highlight for what we want for the future. We want these systems to be clinical validated, to be integrated into practice, to detect, stage, refer, and treat eye diseases earlier to enhance outcomes. And we hope that accessibility improves, home monitoring and patient-acquired data, adding more information. We hope that there's new links and new biomarkers of the eye and systemic diseases. We need good quality input data. We need robust reporting standards. We need external validation. We need collaboration and sharing of ophthalmic data sets, and especially safeguarding participant privacy, securing against data breaches. We need further research and collaboration, safety, and we need to always factor the expense of deep learning and AI within ophthalmology. And we need infrastructure to reduce barriers to implementation and uptake of AI. So telecommunications, cloud based storage, networking, and overall, the overriding aspiration of potential of AI to improve the standard of care and to provide optimum care to every patient in nations that have a shortage of eye specialists is aspirational, is exciting. We want to narrow inequalities around the world to hard to reach areas, and hopefully this technology will enrich rather than take away from our role as clinicians. So we'll have longer and richer consultations with patients, dealing with the subtleties and nuances in ophthalmic and systemic health, which no machine can truly address, at least for the moment. So I hope you enjoyed that. These are some of my references. At the top is this new textbook, which I've written a chapter for ophthalmology in, which is Wiley's AI in Clinical Medicine textbook, a practical kind of layperson's guide to AI in clinical medicine for healthcare professionals. I'm sure there'll be lots and lots more literature of how AI can help us in eye healthcare and in healthcare in general. And I hope that gave some people who might still find AI a little bit of a grey area some background before our podcasts in the Eye on Liverpool series, which will come out over 2023 and the first part of 2024. Thank you and take care.